online. abc.net.au/radionational.
Good morning, I'm Michael Cathcart and this is RN. You're very welcome to Books and Arts Daily. Today, a wonderful project in which women are invited to write letters, which they then read out at public gatherings. And you'll enter the world of geeks and MOOCs. You know what a geek is, but what's a MOOC?
A MOOC is a cross between a book and a magazine. So it's about immediacy and breadth in the way that magazines do, but without giving up the space to go into stuff in considerable detail.
That's coming up later. But now we cross to London to meet Edna O'Brien. Well, the Irish writer Edna O'Brien is quite simply one of the great writers of the English language. She's written over 20 novels, and then there are plays, short stories, screenplays and poetry. Her notable titles include Girl with Green Eyes, August is a Wicked Month, Casualties of Peace, and her biographies of the Irish writer James Joyce and the poet Lord Byron. Her most notable theme is the inner world of women and their experience of sex and passion. Now she's written the book that she swore she would never write, the story of her own life. It's called Country Girl. Edna O'Brien, readers will get that reference immediately. Her very first novel was called The Country Girls. That was published back in 1960, and it was based on her own childhood in the claustrophobic confines of Catholic Ireland and her escape from that world. It was a publishing sensation. It seemed to be the work of a young woman claiming her freedom, a moment before the mighty wave of the 1960s crashed over Western society, and a whole generation of young people was making that very same demand. Edna O'Brien turned 82 at the weekend. Edna, welcome, and a very happy birthday for last Saturday.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
So, Edna, this is the book that you swore you would never write. What's changed?
It's true. Why did I write it? There are two or three answers. One is that I felt I had been sometimes written about in a manner and by people who didn't know much about me and that wasn't truthful or accurate. I think a writer, of which, alas, I am one of that breed and have been for 52 years now, since I wrote The Country Girls in 1958, I think writers' lives are lived very much inside the head, inside the body, inside the mind. And then they deliver, as if I may use such a pregnant word, they deliver into the world a piece of fiction or a drama or a prose. When sometimes people write about writers, those self-same writers, they seem to omit the intensity, passion, the everything that impels that writer. Now, I did not want to write a self-serving memoir which saying, look how intense I am or how passionate or how much I revere language, by the way, all of which I do. But I wanted to write the key moments, the ones that remember themselves to me day in and day out, and that were pivotal in my life, my early life, my convent life, my going off to Dublin to discover, as I thought, poets. All I discovered was hardship, but also city life, so to speak. My marriage, my separation, children, and so on. And I wanted to tell it without, I hope, any gloss or any sentimentality or judgment of other people. I wanted to tell it as I lived it and as I felt it. So that's why I decided to write a memoir.
Edna, can we touch then on some of those important stages of your life? So you were born in 1930, and Catholicism was such an intense force in your childhood. You say that Irish priests and nuns...
Well, it was, and anybody living in that in Ireland at that time would say the same. It was secular, and it was religious or spiritual. It permeated all of life. The priests knew where, you know, who didn't go to Mass, or if one didn't go to Mass, it permeated all of our lives. I the house, our house, was full of holy pictures, and we said the rosary every night. We all knelt down on the kitchen floor, said the rosary. Sometimes there were mice strutting around. That wasn't so good. So that it was more than one would imagine being religious in the year 2012.
Now, presumably, Edna, some people found this a source of consolation and comfort, the sense that the church and faith and that Jesus and Mary were with them always. You seem to have drawn strength from this.
I'm not sure that we should use the word consolation. It was compelling, and it was also very much to do with fear. It was the fear of God rather than the protection of God as Savior. It was God as judge, God as authority. I'm not, by the way, in parenthesis, I would like to say, I am not against religion, but some of the tenets and teaching and suffocation and censoring of the Catholic Church as I lived it and many others lived it in Ireland, I can't speak for other countries, were really not spiritual. They were about authority, about power, and above all about instilling fear. So consolation, it might have been to some, but not really as pervasive as your question suggests.
Well, as you tell us in the book, you lived for a while in the convent, and that's a very intense period in your life. You leave that school and you head off to Wicked Dublin, and that was where you came to a trestle table outside a bookshop, and you bought a book. Can you tell us about that book?
Yes. I worked in a chemist shop. My family wanted me to be a pharmacist. I wanted to be a writer, but they won. And on my half day from the chemist shop, which was very seldom, once a fortnight, I would go into the town, into the hub of the city. It wasn't that much of a hub, but it seemed to me to be. I worked in a rather poor district called Cabra. And in those days in Dublin, as I say in my memoir, bookshops were very, very trusting. And outside the bookshops, with a bit of awning to fend off the perpetual Irish rain, there were lots of books, and reduced in price. There were books that had been, they were second-hand, but also some newish books that had the cover torn or something. And nobody checked whether you stole a book or went in and paid for the book. And I found the yellow cover, yellow paper cover, I still have it, and it was called Introducing James Joyce by T.S. Eliot. And I opened it at random, and I began to read a few lines from Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man. And it was about the Christmas dinner in the Dedalus house, which began so happily, so mirthfully, so hopefully. And then the two danger subjects, politics and sex, came into the narrative. And what had been happy a minute before was now agitated and angry among the character. And when I was reading it, it was beautifully written. It was written with such imagery. The flame on the plum pudding, the cut glass decanters with the light of the fire reflected or glinting on bits of the prism of the glass and so forth. It was perfectly written. But it was also perfectly and uncannily true to Irish life, Irish temperament, and to the battles that go on in families, in friendships, the battle about sex and politics. It's true for the whole world, but it happened to be very true for Ireland. And when I read a paragraph, I thought, this could be our family. This could be any Irish family. It is so credible. It is so cannily true. And yet it is universal. And it was my greatest, and remains my greatest, education as a writer. I bought the book for fourpence, and I have kept the book. There were many other, that was some portrait. There was bits of Ulysses, Finnegan's Wake, two short stories. But it was wonderful. And as a woman no longer young, alas, I would wish that young writers would come on a book like that that was so great and stood the tests of time and read that rather than reading what they've just written, what their friends have just written. Read something marvelous and lasting. And that was my greatest education. And my second greatest one was attending a lecture when I came to London, given by Arthur Meitzner, an American professor, on Ernest Hemingway. And you couldn't get two more different writers than James Joyce and Ernest Hemingway. But you couldn't get two better teachers to a young writer who was writing. I was writing a little bit gushingly. They were my two great educators.
This is Books and Arts Daily on RN, and we're talking to the Irish writer Edna O'Brien just 3 days after her 82nd birthday and on the occasion of the publication of her memoir, which is called Country Girl, a reference, of course, to her very first novel, which was called The Country Girls, which came out in 1960. Let's talk about that novel, Edna. So you left Dublin and you went off to even wickeder London, on the arm of a handsome, dashing Irishman named Ernest Gebler, who was your husband. You'd married him. And you arrive in London, and basically you start to write.
Well, I'd always been trying and writing, in a way, rather, as I said a moment ago, gushingly, certainly foolishly, certainly not with precision. But I loved writing, and I loved reading poetry and great writing. And what I think changed me, suddenly, what I began to write had something deeper in it and something truer. And that came about because of the separation from my own country. I never realized how much Ireland meant to me until I left it. Now, I wanted to leave it. I was agog to leave it. And yet, having left it, I felt for the first time what exile is. Mine was relatively comfortable in that I left by my own choice. I wasn't a convict being sent on a boat to your country, or for that matter to any country. I was free, and I wanted to leave, and still I knew that I had left behind something that had formed me, that had formed my inner life and my feelings about God or history or literature or love or anything else. And that is what changed me internally and therefore changed my text. I wrote The Country Girls. I was asked to write it by a publisher because I used to read novels for publishers. I used to do a report on novels for a guinea. And my reports were, I think, rather, they were certainly probably audacious. So this publisher, God rest him, Ian Hamilton, he felt I could write a novel. So he and Blanche Knopf from Knopf in New York commissioned my novel for the noble sum of £50, which I summarily spent being of an extravagant tendency.
Splendid.
And that's when I wrote The Country Girls, and I was very, very lucky. And I mean that. I was very, very lucky in that it hit a button, or it hit a nerve end, that it was a success, and it set me on my road.
Well, it's a very autobiographical novel. It's about two Irish girls who basically break out of the convent. There's Kate and there's Bubba. One more or less the good girl, and the other one the wild girl, just bursting to break out. I guess in some ways they were two sides of yourself.
I would think so. People often ask me, who is Bubba? Mm. Who is the rebellious, outspoken? And I always say, Baba's the girl I wish to be. So there was the obedient, poetic Kate, and there was the wild and outspoken Baba, and they're two halves, really, of the same person.
Edna, I'm looking at the cover of your memoir, Country Girl, and on the cover, there's a very arresting photograph of a young woman with a 60s haircut smoking a cigarette. Tell me who that girl is.
I'll try and tell you, but I'm not sure either. Certainly, the photograph is of me, and it was taken by a photographer called Horst Tappe. And, you know, I smoked a bit at that time, but I was never really what you would call a committed smoker. So I'm holding the cigarette with, I think, some affectation, to tell you the truth. But he wanted that. Well, maybe I wanted it. I don't know. That's how it came about. And had that sort of bobbed hairdo of the 60s. That's in the cosmetic answer to your question. Who that girl was the very person who would go through the hills and the hollows and the ups and downs of love and lack of love, money and lack of money, and the different vicissitudes of life. And that was all in there, even though that photograph does not suggest it, because we are what we are, what we are.
You talk very candidly in this book about all of those things, the vicissitudes of life and the search for love and love thwarted. You talk about the affairs that you've had, often with married men. And you also talk astonishingly candidly about the psychological crises that you went through and your encounters with the anti-psychiatrist R.D. Lang. Can you just talk to me about him and what he meant to you?
Well, he was a very magnetic person, R.D. Lang, and was very revered in that time in the 60s and 70s in London. He had written very interesting books, Bird of Paradise, The Divided Self, The Self and Others. And a lot of people, including myself, felt that he was saying something original that had not been said before. I mean, his thesis, his tenet, which is a bit probably over the top, is, you know, that the mad are sane and the sane are really the mad ones. But it has some truth. But he was also poetic, in especially The Bird of Paradise. His hero, as I once learned, was Baudelaire. Now, he ain't Baudelaire, let's be very clear. But I, like lots of people, fell, so to speak, under his spell, and I took LSD at my own choice. He did not force it on me. I would like to emphasize that. And I wasn't the best candidate for LSD because I think I have some, what shall we call it, native LSD in me without having to take it as a substance. I think I have it in the old brain cells. So I had a very frightening and lastingly frightening trip. He stayed with me for some hours, but then I was alone, as I describe in the. And it was traumatic, and it was a brainstorm.
Now, can I read to you what you actually wrote? Because it's very cutting. You describe him as half Lucifer, half Christ. And you say that he dosed you up with LSD, and then, this is the quote, sent me packing with an opened scream.
Yes, that is the truth. He was half Lucifer, half Christ, because he was both a healer and a killer, or whatever Lucifer is. And he did experiment with people's minds. His intentions were partly to open people's minds, including mine, but he did not always take into account the consequences. So when I say he left me with an open scream, he would say, and indeed did say, when I went to see him about 4 weeks after I'd had the thing, that I had personally and by myself, for my own development, to scream that scream. He couldn't scream it for me. I had to do it, and he enabled me.
What was it that drew you to him? Were you yourself in some state of psychological distress that you should seek
Name me a writer who isn't in psychological distress. They wouldn't be writers unless they were in distress and, complex and turbulent and disturbed. Harmonious, happy, or, for that matter, business people are not creative people. They're not. So, of course, I was disturbed. So what drew me to him was the fascination that he could give me something for my imaginative development that I couldn't do myself.
So the search for happiness isn't at the top of your aspirations?
Oh, I'd love to be happy. I'm happy sometimes. I'm not a complete moaner. But, happiness is not a permanent situation. And if you look at the world today, if you look at newsreels, if you look turn on your radio or television any minute, I mean, no one can be happy who has any degree of intelligence or sympathy or thought about the world at large. But yes, of course, certainly in my young days, I dreamed of, romantic love, happiness. The fact that all those things are not fulfilled doesn't mean that I am unhappy or bitter. I feel I've had a wonderful life. I've been allowed to write what I want to write. I've made my livelihood, which is not hugely, but I've made my livelihood through writing. I have great children whom I love, and I think I'm loved in return. So I'm happy in many aspects, and yet, of course, not happy. First of all, continuing to write is very, very hard. And also, as I said a moment ago, the feeling of the world at large and what is happening in the world, and one feels so impotent of being really not able to do much about that.
Can we end where we began? We talked about Ireland at the start. Can you talk about how that island has changed since Kate and Bubba ran away from the convent to the bright lights of Dublin?
Oh, Ireland has changed a lot. It has changed, re-changed, unchanged, changed again. Ireland in that time was very repressive, and books were banned by the minute, including mine. Ireland then broke out of those shackles of censorship and religious superstition, and went through each decade of changes. It became a bit better off, mainly by, especially through becoming part of the European Union, and people got grants to build off of bungalows and things. And then Ireland became, as the world knows, so successful. Celtic Tiger, which was a model to the entire world in its bravura and chameleon success. And then 2 years ago, or maybe it's three by now, Ireland went broke. Some people remained rich, but many people did not. So therefore, the financial or economic blow to Ireland was catastrophic in financial terms and in emotional terms. And coinciding with it were two major, not called investigation, but it's a word like that, on the cover-up of the abuse of children in Catholic institutions. So church and state betrayed Ireland. So when you ask me to describe the Ireland I grew up in, something is the same. The landscape is the same. Nature is the same. You still get lonely people in the country, and you get probably young women like me who's dying to write about something they feel strongly about and also dying to escape. And you get the empty houses that these builders and sharks were building and never finished. And you get the wounds that have happened as a result of these very quick transitions that happened in Ireland. And you still get, as I say in my memoir, you get the odd poet. And like the landscape and the emotional pulse in a lot of Ireland, that's the best thing about it. Not the bankers with the BMWs, and not very much the politicians. But you get a feeling for poetry that I have not ever encountered in any other country.
Edna O'Brien, it's been a real privilege to talk to you today. Thank you for being my guest here on the program.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye now. God bless.
Edna O'Brien, and her memoir is called Country Girl, and it's published by Faber. This is Books and Arts on RN with Michael Cathcart. Well, now, lots of women who write, they write letters.
Wait, oh yes, wait a minute, Mr. Postman. Wait, wait, hey, 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 Mr. Postman.
Hey, Mr. Postman, look and see.
Oh yeah,
is there a letter in your bag for me?
Please, Mr. Postman.
Well, when was the last time you wrote a letter to a friend and trusted Mr. Postman to deliver it to your friend or to your loved one? And when was the last time that you received a letter, a lovely letter with a hand-written, hand-addressed envelope through the post? Letter writing is fast becoming a lost art, but recently it's had a revival thanks to a series of events called Women of Letters. Now, these events were begun in 2010 by the writers Marika Hardy and Michaela Maguire. And the idea is that famous and lesser-known women read a letter that they've written in front of an audience. And usually there's a theme to the letter. It might be an apology or a letter to a treasured possession, something like that. This is the second year the letters from these events have been published, put together in a single volume. And they're letters from Ita Buttrose, Kate Miller-Heidke, Helen Garner. There's even one from my wife, I noticed. And letters from my guests, Angie Hart and Emily Maguire. Angie Hart was the lead singer of the popular 90s band Frente. She's now a solo performer and she's in our Melbourne studio. Angie, welcome.
Hello.
And Emily Maguire is an author of essays, fiction and non-fiction, and she's in our Sydney studios. Emily, welcome.
Hi.
Are you normally a letter writer, Emily?
Look, not lately. I was as a child and even well into my teens, I would write pages and pages of letters. I mean, every day I would write letters to exchange with school friends on the bus in the morning, and we'd sit next to each other reading letters from each other from the night before. But I just last week was doing my sort of annual clean out of my home office, and I realised I have all this gorgeous notepaper and all these wonderful stationery sets that I haven't used for years.
It does seem a little weird. You mean you met your friends and you didn't really talk. You just said, here, read this.
Just to start with, that was how we started our days, was reading letters from each other. It was this beautiful kind of ritual to ease into our days. We would write to each other every night.
What about you, Angie? Are there letters now or in your past?
Yeah, I think I made it up into my early 30s before I kind of ebbed on the letter writing, which I've lived in the US for about 9 years and moved back in my early 30s. So I kept writing letters up until then, and I still get letters from friends in the US, and sometimes I write back.
In an envelope?
I actually put a stamp on there and send it.
Do you write with a pen, or do you type it on your computer, print it out, then put it in
the envelope? Oh, no, with a pen, yeah, absolutely, which, you know, they're just verbal spews, which that's compared to writing a letter for Women of Letters where you sit down and really give it some thought. It's making me rethink the letter.
It's weird, isn't it, the different impact from a letter that's written in pen from a letter that's written on a computer. I mean, if you got a letter from your solicitor written in pencil or in purple pen, you'd think, this is weird. I want it typed with a kind of disciplined little signature at the bottom. But a letter from a friend that's written, handwritten, has a whole different impact.
It's so much more personal. I mean, a typed letter that's printed off, unless, you know, my mum was saying people can't read her handwriting anymore, and so she's considering moving to type soon. But she hasn't yet.
She hasn't.
It's nice to get a handwritten letter.
Yeah, I think so. So, Emily, explain how this works, the actual event, the Women of Letters event. What's going on?
It's such a gorgeous event. So it's once a month. It's usually in Melbourne, although they have done a roadshow and visited other cities. And it's basically five women, or occasionally five men for special events, who all write a letter specifically for the event. And it's around a theme. So, you know, it could be as simple as a love letter or a letter to the things I never told my mother or something like that. And one by one, we each get up and read our letter to the audience. There's a break in the middle where members of the audience are encouraged to write letters of their own while they're feeling inspired by events. And all proceeds from the event and from the books go to Edgar's Mission, which is an animal rescue shelter. But it's just a really, you know, I'd heard about this event heaps before I was able to go, because I'm in Sydney and it's usually in Melbourne. And I'd heard about just this unique atmosphere of this really kind of warm, intimate atmosphere, and it really is. It's gorgeous.
I've seen this at second hand because my wife Hanny has done two or three of these, and each time she's come home on an absolute high.
It's a unique atmosphere from just a feeling of, you know, it sounds odd, but trust in the room. The letters tend to be really quite intimate a lot of the time, and there's a real feeling from everyone in the room that they're with you on that.
Now, yeah. Angie, you've written a letter which is to the best decision I ever made. It's all about your first marriage, and it really is intimate.
Yes.
I mean, you tell us everything.
I told even more on the day. We've cut some of that out for legal purposes.
So your first marriage was not really, it wasn't the marriage that was the best decision you ever made.
No, it was pretty much anything but I also, I guess it was a cathartic rite, because I did want to say that it wasn't the worst decision I made either. It just, at the time, seemed like it.
Perhaps you could read a little bit of it for
us. I'd love to.
Okay.
Look at that. It's all bookmarked and everything.
You've come prepared.
All right. I thought being with you elevated my worth, and hopefully I'd even see myself in a better light. I thought my animal instincts had led me to a different kind of mate by scent. that in your odour, which was alien to my kind, I'd be rewarded with a different and better life, and of course healthy children, as was the Darwinian genetic code. I wasn't entirely wrong. I mean, one out of three, come on. Out of different, better, or healthy children, I got different. Better? Things were never worse. I had quit my highly successful band Frente, moved countries, and married a man I didn't know. We were self-employed, sharing a one-bedroom apartment, and a problem. Children? I made sure we didn't have any. We started a band together. We called it Splendid. I'll just let that hang there for a moment. There were other things too. Good things. That was confusing. We made beautiful music together, not a metaphor.
Mm. Well, as you say, you left a band called Frente, which is very popular, a band that made sounds like this.
Accidentally Cali Street, where friends and strangers sometimes meet. Accidentally Cali Street, I never thought life could be so sweet.
I'm so pleased to be talking to you this morning because I heard that song about 3 weeks ago on Rage and thought it was great. And here you are. Isn't life spooky?
Very.
So you left the band, that band,
yes,
for this marriage. And as you say, the two of you formed a duo called Splendid, although things weren't so splendid. Did the musical connection fuel a relationship that otherwise wasn't working? Is that what was going on?
A musical relationships are always so confusing. I had in Frente, Simon Austin and I were a writing duo, and there's a chemistry about writing songs that's different. It's a whole relationship in itself, and it can confuse things. It's very intimate to write songs together.
The car seems to be a fraught issue for you. Decorum and the car, and who can drive the car, eating in the car.
I guess I was trying to give examples that were palatable and things that I would make public, and the car was a great example of other things that I really didn't want to talk about in my letter.
He wouldn't let you drive his car.
I couldn't eat in the car. I couldn't put my makeup on in the car. The car was sacred and I definitely wasn't allowed to drive it.
Now, as we're hearing, this is a very intimate letter.
Yes.
And it's a very intimate conversation with someone else who might be saying at this moment, well, come on, you know, relations are private. This went on between the two of us. This is not something to be broadcasting to the world about or getting up with a group of ladies and amusing them with your, you know, with your insinuations.
Yeah, and I'm sure, you know, that he would be none too thrilled. During the time that we were together, I wrote about our relationship the entire time in all of our songs.
In the songs. And
he was very okay with that. But that was
It's a bit different because a pop song turns into something general.
Yes, and it's
even
shrouded,
though,
yes.
Yeah, you know it's personal.
Yes.
But to me, it's just a girl walking along the street singing about how she no longer loves a guy. So the barbed imagery that you're delivering to the person you wish to hurt, I don't know what that is. That's the mystery of the pop song, isn't it?
And in writing this letter, that was the one thing that I wanted, was not to hurt anybody. And so I did want to say all of these things. I think it's important for other women that have been through this kind of a relationship to know about it and to identify with it. And my aim was not to, you know, take out a knife and stab the person that did this, or they didn't do anything. We did it together.
Did it help you?
It was great to read it out. I thought I would get up. Women of Letters, whenever you do a Women of Letters or whenever you're watching a Women of Letters, there will be tears at some stage and you will laugh most of the time. I thought I was going to be the person that cried on that day, and the two women that got up and read before me wept during their pieces. By the time I got up, I was fine.
Right. Do they have tissues on hand? Is it like going to the counsellor? This is Books and Arts Daily on RN. I'm Michael Cathcart. We don't have tissues in the studio here, but we should. We're talking about Women of Letters with musician, singer Angie Hart and writer Emily Maguire. Emily, your letter isn't to one person. It's supposed to be to the person I misjudged, but you've misjudged a whole category of people.
Yeah, when I first started, writing the letter, and I started writing it about this friend of mine in my first year of high school, and then as I wrote it, I realised, it wasn't just her, it was this whole group of girls. And then I realised that this was a real pattern. So I decided to write about that pattern of, really, when I was young, I thought being a girl was a pretty awful thing, and I was pretty determined to be the exception to that. And because of that, I misjudged all these just fantastic girls who I knew throughout the, you know, throughout my childhood and teen years.
You end up quoting Pride and Prejudice, saying, this is the quote, "I was one of those young ladies who seek to recommend themselves to the other sex by undervaluing their own." Mm-hmm. You're quoting what Caroline Bingley says of Elizabeth Bennet. How did you come to realise that was you?
It was a fairly slow process, and it would kind of happened in stages. So the first stage was actually finding a group of girls who I did really, you know, love and thought they were as exceptional as I was. So we were all like boys because we were so cool. And it slowly had to sink in that how ridiculous that was.
Now, I'm having trouble following this. Would that be the DERV Club, or would that be the 9-year pissheads, or would that the Monday morning shame gang? Because you address each of those clusters of girls and apologise to each of them.
Yeah, that was the Dave Club.
Oh, right.
So we were we were self named deviants, and we actually had a shelf in my bedroom where we would put the spoils from our deviants.
So you went from being a deviant to being a year 9 pisshead, is that right?
those things happened at the same time. It was it was good times.
And you revered a character, the character Scout from To Kill a Mockingbird.
Yeah, something we felt, and it's really interesting going back and reading that book now, because she's still such a fantastic character and I still love her, but she has this whole thing too that, you know, ladies are dull and boring and you have to change your behaviour and they don't know how to have fun, and it's much better to be a boy and also to make it very clear how much you like boys and men, and that you know, not like the ladies who expect more from them.
So you apologise to each of these groups of girls. You actually establish a kind of feminist solidarity with girls all the way back to kindergarten and apologise mm-hmm. to them for having, well, basically ratted on them and sided with the boys.
Mm-hmm.
And how did it feel doing that at Women of Letters in front of, I guess, an audience of women?
Look, it felt a little bit risky to basically stand up and confess that you know, in the past have been a total bitch to other women and girls just because they're women and girls. It felt risky, but I also felt, you know, in conversations I've had with a lot of women as an adult, that it's quite a common thing with a lot of girls and women to think, you know, to kind of boast that I only have male friends and I'm not like other girls and I'm such a tomboy, as this is, you know, you're better somehow if you're not girly. And I think it's a really important thing to talk about and to get away from that kind of childish place of thinking that way.
Well, it's been wonderful to meet both of you and to hear an argument for reclaiming the letter. Thank you for coming by.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Emily Maguire is an essayist and author of 4 novels and a couple of non-fiction books. Her latest novel is Fishing for Tigers. And Angie Hart was the lead singer of Frente. She's now a solo artist, and her latest album is called Eat My Shadow. And the book is called Sincerely, Women of Letters. It's published by Viking. This is Books and Arts Daily on RN, and you're with Michael Cathcart. Well, are you a geek? It's pretty cool to be a geek these days. They even have their own TV series, the enormously popular Big Bang Theory. The series feeds off many stereotypes of geekiness, particularly the person who is super bright, but also super socially awkward. But there are many facets of geek culture not represented in mainstream culture, and many geeks, just don't feel very cool. And all this is explored in the latest MOOC. Now, a MOOC, or a MOOC, is a cross between a book and a magazine. The Geek MOOC is the third in a series that's already plumbed the themes of sex and death. The Geek MOOC is a collection of short stories, poems and essays on every aspect of geek culture and some less obvious obsessions on the geek spectrum. Sarah Lestrange put on her reading glasses to up her credentials on geeks and MOOCs.
I suppose if you think of a geek as someone who has a particular and abiding and deep interest in a certain topic, then yes, I probably am a bit of a geek.
To me, it's partly a reminder of the sorts of impulses and urges I had when I was younger, a sense of playfulness, for example, or a willingness to look at things afresh. And for a philosopher, that can be very valuable.
Both the beauty and possibly the danger of geekdom is that we will go as far as we can in the direction of what we love without reference to the rest of the world.
Aaron Mannion is one of the editors of the latest book series. Anastasia Cox and Damon Young are two of the many contributors to this geek MOOC. And here's that definition again of a MOOC from Aaron, whose geek cred is based on his love of maths, but also the author Charlotte Bronte.
A MOOC is a cross between a book and a magazine. So it's about immediacy and breadth in the way that magazines do, but without giving up the space to go into stuff in considerable detail and also with considerable kind of seriousness.
Even though geeks and nerds have been embraced by mainstream culture, just turn on the television any night of the week, it really still is on the margins. For those many geeks who don't make it onto TV with their obsessions or because of their sense of humour.
Geek culture is kind of mainstream, but I'm still not convinced that the actual geeks are. There's less of an abyss between them and mainstream culture now. There's so many kind of bridges crossing that. But the geeks still are a little bit different. That's partly sort of their psychology, but also it's that extreme intensity. You probably don't quite constitute a geek unless it's possibly slightly damaging to your life, your obsession, whatever that is, or damaging at least to what's seen as a rounded and balanced life. Yeah.
So how do you position yourself within that damage spectrum?
I think possibly not near the extreme, and kind of most of my geekdom is probably centered around literature, which is kind of much more, it's got kind of obvious cultural capital, so you can kind of get away with it.
Harder to get away with a deep obsession with Star Trek, perhaps?
It is. It is harder, I think, and people look down on you much more. You say you spent the last 18 hours in bed reading Proust, that's fine. If you spent the last 18 hours in bed watching The Next Generation, people probably won't look quite as kindly on that or feel that you've spent your time as well.
Don't tell this to Damon Young.
I'm a philosopher and author. I write for the newspapers and for the ABC, and I'm also a Trekker.
A Trekker?
Yes, a Star Trek fan. I have, I think, all of Next Generation on DVD. I have the original series now on iTunes. I have a little die-cast Enterprise sitting next to the charioteer from Delphi, next to my writing desk. And next to that is a small Borg cube. The Borg are an alien antagonist from Star Trek, and there's the little toy cube with figurines in it, and my wife bought that for me a long time ago. So that's sitting next to these Greek antiquities.
And here's my favourite one.
I also have a pair of sterling silver cufflinks modelled on the Starfleet insignia that I like to wear just quietly to formal events, along with my Hulk and Transformers t-shirts sometimes.
Space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission, to explore strange new worlds.
Alongside Dungeons and Dragons, Star Trek is the traditional stomping ground of a geek. Damon Young's love affair began as a teenager with the series Next Generation, at a time when geekdom hadn't been redeemed by popular culture. Behind the costumes and the array of pointy-eared aliens, Damon says the Next Generation is also a prime stomping ground for philosophers.
The Next Generation featured an older, bald English captain, which was quite different from the sort of strutting cock of Kirk. And the captain of the Next Generation, Jean-Luc Picard, I suppose to me embodied the sort of man I wanted to be when I was a teenager. He was physically able, but he was also very cerebral and had a host of very important virtues. I suppose you could say there's a nobility to him.
Damon Young is also drawn to themes in the original Star Trek on risk-taking, friendship, ambition, and alienation. He writes about this in the Geek MOOC.
What appealed to me were these very specific qualities. Risk is one of them, and Captain Kirk is someone who you might not necessarily want to invite to a dinner party. He can be brash, incredibly arrogant, and hard to be around. But when it comes to that decisive moment, he is the one who will act. And that's something that comes across again and again. Another theme, as you said, is alienation. And Kirk is an outsider. He's very bright, but also never at home where he is. He's meant for something more, but he doesn't know what that is. Likewise, his friend Spock, the Vulcan, is an outsider. He's half human on Vulcan, and they are prejudiced against him. And these two outsiders manage to become friends, which is itself another theme. Friendship in Star Trek, but often between those two, often involves conflict. And that, to me, is a very strong Nietzschean message, that enemies are those who can make the best friends, those who will oppose you, who will contradict you, who will not put up with your crap. And I like that in Star Trek. I like Kirk in particular, his willingness to go at things, go head-to-head and see who wins, and between friends.
Despite all of these philosophical benefits, I'm still not sure if I'm going to give Star Trek another go. Staying in space, but within the accepted laws of physics. This is a recording from Valentina Tereshkova's first mission into space for the USSR. Anastasia Cox has a special bond with Valentina and wrote a poem about her that's featured in the Geek MOOC.
Valentina was the first woman to go into space. She went into space on the 16th of June in 1963, and she had been a not particularly well-educated textile worker and amateur parachutist. And she was chosen out of, I think, more than 400 women as part of the Soviet propaganda drive to send a woman into space to enhance the proletariat nature of the space program in Russia, in the Soviet Union. She was an amazingly brave and self-possessed woman and went to space really very young, and ended up in her first and only mission spending more time in space than all the American astronauts to that point put together.
Like many people, Anastasia Cox's interest in space began when she was young, gazing up at the stars and wondering what was out there.
Unlike some kids, I kind of never got over it, and I just found more and more ways to explore it. And so people like Valentina Tereshkova were fascinating to me from a young age. And also she went to space on my birthday, so that helped.
That definitely
helps. It's personal,
helps.
You know, and that's the thing. It's personal. I don't just have a scientific interest. It's something I have a feeling about.
Such is her obsession. Against her own travel agent's advice, 14 years ago, Anastasia Cox did a tour of the former Soviet Union's neglected space museums, which apparently look like something out of a Tarkovsky film. And she even interviewed a former cosmonaut.
I actually managed to secure a coffee date with Alexei Leonov, who was the first cosmonaut to walk in space. And so I had a relatively brief but fascinating little conversation with him. And he's obviously an absolutely incredible person to have met. And he's interesting because he's... you know, he became a banker after he was a cosmonaut, but he also has painted all his life. And so I'm very interested in the visual arts connected to space travel as well. So it was really interesting to talk to him about the way it affected him emotionally going to space. And he was quite happy to talk about that.
So how did it affect him?
In different ways, I guess. There's part of him that was very strong and very forthright and seemed, you know, he's a major general in the Soviet Air Force and he was a banker. But there was this other side to him that was melancholy, and I've found this reading a lot about cosmonauts and astronauts as well, that there's something that happens to them that they never quite get over, that, you know, you go on a holiday and you leave a little part of yourself where you go, but going to space, it's the ultimate holiday, I guess. You leave something quite profound behind. And it's actually really hard for these people to put it into words, which is why I think, although sometimes the artwork that they do isn't, you know, what you'd call of the highest quality, it's kind of beautiful because it's their way of trying to come to terms with this thing they've had to leave behind and the melancholy.
Like Star Trek, space travel is traditional geek territory, but Anastasia Cox brings a poetic sensitivity to this wondrous domain.
I don't know a huge amount about the technical workings of spacecraft, or I probably know more than the average person, but for me it is an emotional and artistic interest really that I have in the idea of space travel. So yeah, that's what geek means to me, which is a kind of a fairly personal reading, I guess. So the poem I'm going to read is called Chaika, and Chaika is the Russian word for seagull. It was the call sign for cosmonaut Valentina Tereshkova's 16th of June 1963 flight into space, which made her the first woman in space. It was not yet time for your one-way trip. There was no Mars to aim for, no child decided. You were gut-wrenched, a whole right angle wrong. They took so long to let you down. It was a cheap shot, spam in a can, on Bloom's Day. Your Belarusian thighs strapped in, famous to be first girl in space. Nothing to pass the expanding days but tests, measurements, shutting up. Your life worth less than a man's embarrassment. They hadn't counted on the cramping, though, on the cold feet, the warm heart, Valentina. You didn't need a compass to know you were the wrong way up. You told the men on the ground with their directives and their levers. You said, I am not shooting off into a black, blacker than step night. You said, I am not proletarian space junk. You said, Niet. They said you had gone quiet. And so you went quiet. Sitting in a darkness with no wheel at its centre, waiting, cramping, you thought of Irina on the rocket bus, still spacesuited, inconsolable. She had hoped but not hoped you would collapse, decompress, expire. She was still crying on the tarmac while you thought this. They sent up a man to watch over you, all that space, and he crowded you, performed a flyby. You felt ill. The horizon didn't help, and the stale black bread it centrifuged inside. It made you, seagull, into an albatross. A single spinneret saved you, you who knew more about parachutes than any man, your hands and your mother's hands, makers of the weave and the weft, a miraculous disagreement designed to resist solid land, to hold you close under a web of down until air flashing, fields of wheat and rye flashing, silos flashing, you lay gasping, glittering, laughing, face up under the sun. Hidden heat held higher than you. It meant home.
Anastasia Cox with the poem Chaika from the Geek MOOC, and the Geek MOOC is published by Vignette Press. And we also heard from Damon Young, a familiar voice on RN. His latest book is Philosophy in the Garden, published by Melbourne University Press, and that story was from Sarah Lestrange. Well, that's our Books and Arts Daily for this morning. We do this every weekday at 10 a.m, and tomorrow we're going to look at meet the famous sculptor Anish Kapoor. He joins us, and also a novel about the skullduggery of the New Guard's leader, Eric Campbell. And after the news, it's Bush Telly with Cameron Wilson, looking at a new smartphone app which may save an Indigenous language. It's been good to have your company. Let's meet again tomorrow. I'm Michael Cathcart, and this is RN. We're just coming up to news time. Bye now.
Fatah and Hamas really represent two very different approaches towards realizing Palestinian political ambitions.
Fatah accepts negotiation and the two-state solution. Hamas favours armed resistance and refuses to give way on the issue of land. After 20 years, both have failed. So where to now for Palestinian politics? That's Rear Vision. You can download or stream this program from the RN website.